I know you're out there. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
Connecting the dots of the Constitution for you like no one else can. The Chris Ann Hall Show. American woman, listen what I say. She's an attorney, a disabled U.S. Army veteran, an author, public speaker, mother, pastor's wife, and a patriot. She's Chris Ann Hall.
Loving patriots, welcome to the Chris Ann Hall Show. Chris Ann Hall here, ChrisAnneHall.com. Liberty over security, principle over party, and truth over your favorite personality. For today's show, I have with me my husband, JC Hall, and we have a special show planned for you today in response to something that I did on Facebook and Twitter. I asked the question to all the people in Facebook and Twitterverse, tell me your Constitution question for today. And we compiled those questions, and that's what we're going to do today. A little question and answer. We had a lot of questions, didn't we? A lot of the questions were the same questions.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of people who have interest in the Constitution and in a lot of different ways, but in very similar terms as well. So that's pretty much the introduction that I'm going to have for you today in this special What is Your Constitution question? And I'm going to turn over the questioning to JC. And I'm hoping that you guys are going to enjoy this because this is going to be more, I think, of a question-answer dialogue thing because maybe it's a little insight on a car trip with the Hall family.
Maybe. We'll see.
We'll see. All right. So what is our first question?
One of the things that came up and I guess sort of coincides with a common theme of, you know, you encouraging people to know their history and those that do not know their history are doomed to repeat its mistakes. And so one of the comments and questions was, it's amazing how the Declaration of Independence could be compared to our own time. So could you speak to some of the similar problems that the colonists were experiencing, some of the similar complaints, and how does that relate to what's going on today?
You know, what's really interesting is I do a radio interview every week with Kate Daly on the Kate Daly Show. And this week, we had that same thing come up. She had seen on the internet somewhere the anniversary of one of the writing of the Anti-Federalist Papers. And she said to me, I read this Anti-Federalist Papers, and I could not believe how relevant his warning was. And she kept going, it was 1778 when he was making this warning. How relevant is it? And immediately I have to respond, it's because history always repeats, because human nature never changes, and people never change. But Solomon said, there is nothing new under the sun. So the history class that we teach, the genealogy of the Constitution, which is available at Liberty First University, and I mean, I teach this in the high schools and the middle schools too, and the kids are amazed by what they learn. But the history, every student from, I don't know, how old is middle school? Like 12? Yeah, 13? So for anywhere from 12 to 96, they all come up with the same response. How exactly that history repeats today. And that's why the Declaration of Independence seems so relevant today, not because it's unusual that we're repeating that history, but that's the way it always works. And the funny thing is, or the interesting thing is that Declaration of Independence is simply Thomas Jefferson taking grievances from other documents that were actually levied against kings 500, 600, 700 years ago. So there's actually nothing new in the Declaration of Independence. It's Thomas Jefferson repeating the grievances of the people that had been levied against the king for 700 years.
And so what are some of those things? What were some of the complaints like that we would see today? You would say, hey, the same thing they complained about is going on today.
Well, I think that...
Give us some examples.
The Grand Remonstrance of 1641 is the perfect example. So in 1641, the English people levied grievances against their King Charles I in a document called the Grand Remonstrance of 1641. And in that document, they remarked that they'd been studying now government for about 600 years, and they're noticing a pattern. They say, the root of all this mischief we find to be a malignant and pernicious design. And in that design, in those grievances, they list a pattern. Corruption of the court system. Infiltration of foreign law. Government involving itself, controlling the church. Government diminishing the property rights of the people. Government creating fiat money, deviating from the gold and silver standard to manipulate the people through the monetary system, and the government disarming the people while the government remained armed. And that was 1641. And that was the grievances they said in 1641. They remarked that had been occurring for 600 years their time. So now we're talking, you know, from 1600 to our time is what? 400 years. Is that right? Did I do that math right?
I thought I was asking you a question. So then some of the same grievances, some of the same complaints were in the Declaration of Independence mm-hmm. that were in these previous documents. And of course, we still see corruption of the courts. We see, I mean, they talk about political prisoners, essentially, mm-hmm. people being held without due process, indefinite detention.
One of my favorite grievances in the Declaration of Independence is he has established a multitude of new offices whose officers are sent out to harass our people and eat up their substances.
Right.
I mean, that is a regulatory agency right there in definition, 1776.
It's interesting. Before I get to this one, because you bring up these regulatory agencies, a lot of times when you hear the discussion about the fight for independence, the focus is on taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But something interesting about the Declaration of Independence, you mentioned in how it's constructed mm-hmm. related to taxes, because taxes is made to sound like that's the main
right.
problem that they had. They didn't want to pay their taxes, so they overthrew their government.
Well, you actually have to get to the 17th grievance in the Declaration of Independence before you see any mention of taxes.
Right.
So the first 16 grievances have to do with the king setting aside their rights, the king ignoring parliamentary law, the king ignoring the established rights of Englishmen, the king overtaking the courts and making the judges loyal to him and the king controlling the courts. And I mean, like I said, there's 16 different grievances before you get to taxation. And people, Americans, because we don't study history the way we should, we don't realize that the real reason for our independence was much broader than taxation.
Mm-hmm. And you know, that makes me think of, there are a lot of people from overseas, other countries that listen to your show
mm-hmm.
or watch the show on television, watch CTN. So when we talk about the Declaration of Independence and we talk about the history that you teach that leads up to those founding documents, it's really not just an American history, is it?
I mean, no.
It's this. So when we're talking about this, it's not just, hey, Americans could benefit from knowing this. Can you speak to that as the idea that it's a history of liberty?
Right, right. Well, the Declaration of Independence doesn't start off with these are the rights of Americans.
Right.
It starts off, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And so the foundation of America is built on the principles of natural law, which are universal through humankind, that we all, humankind, have a right to life, liberty. Samuel Adams said property and the right to defend your life, your liberty, and your property, all being the natural rights of the people stemming, as Samuel Adams said, from the first law of nature, the duty of self-preservation.
Right. And it's, you had an article recently published, I think, in Poland.
I totally forgot about it.
Poland. So, you know, these are universal principles, and it's always interesting that the focus, when you talk about the American so-called revolution, and they fixate on the taxes, and, you know, you have this caricature of America, the prosperous country, and it's all about money, and so everything is sort of focused on money, but it misses those broader principles. If there was more going on to that, it was not just about America being prosperous and they didn't want to lose their prosperity, it's the issue of those natural rights, the natural liberty that is inherent within every living, breathing human being by the nature of their creation, by the nature of their existence. And so I think you would say, I would agree with you, that anybody around the world, it would be helpful for them to know this history, to study this history, that they may not have, they may not share the same history where that liberty was fought for and has been enjoyed.
Right. And incorporated within the principles and tenets of their government.
So they're not in contact with this as much in their country. And so this history could really sort of help educate them on what their liberties ought to be and what a government really should operate like if it is to secure liberty, which should be its job, its due.
Yeah. Unlike the testimony that Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave before the country of Egypt, that our Constitution is not a document that other countries should model after, quite to the contrary, because the purpose of our Constitution was to secure the blessings of liberty. And that's what the Declaration of Independence is all about.
I'm Chris Ann Hall, and if you agree with me, as Samuel Adams said, that knowledge and virtue are the keys to preserving liberty, then join me for free at Liberty First University. For a limited time, we are offering a 5-day trial membership at no cost and no risk to you. But as Sam Adams said, our ignorance may cost us our liberties. Go to libertyfirstuniversity.com and enroll today for your 5-day free trial membership.
To the Chris Ann Hall Show. You know, we left off with this idea that, and this understanding that the Declaration of Independence was not about taxes. I want to sort of drive a point home here that it wasn't even about the amount of taxation. It was the fact that they were being assessed taxes while being denied their right to representation. And they all referred to, Samuel Adams was one of the strongest speakers about this, that taxation without representation was the equivalent of slavery. Because if you can't control the level of taxation, then the people who have power over you have unlimited power over you.
Right.
To seize your property and everything, your prosperity, they'll tax your mind, Samuel Adams said, if they could get away with it.
But isn't the intent to go further than just the control of the taxes?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're supposed to be able to control the spending.
Right,
well.
Right.
I mean, there's some Madison or someone talked about being the greatest check. You know,
yeah, it was Madison and Jefferson both.
Yeah. So can you speak to that? I mean, how is that supposed to work? So the designers were up in arms about taxation without representation, if we don't have a say, if we don't have a control over the spending, the level of spending, you know, unauthorized spending, aren't we in the same boat?
Right, and that I think that was the whole point. Thomas Jefferson in 1775 wrote a letter to Lord North, and he explained that this taxation is in the hands of the people. And it's the power of the purse, as they called it. He said, our power to withhold the payment of taxes is the greatest check and balance. And Jefferson even said, the greatest exercise of our right to redress the grievances that we have against the government. So our First Amendment says that we have a right to petition the government for a redress of our grievances. Jefferson said, the right to withhold our taxes is an expression of that what we would call the First Amendment today.
Right.
And in the deliberation and the debate over the creation of our legislative branch and the power to tax and spend, there was a discussion because the power to tax and spend was reserved to the House. And the discussion was, why not the Senate? And Madison explained it was because the House is the direct representatives of the people. And the House, being the direct representatives of the people, are the ones that are most closely connected with the people in what they want, and that the people's control over their representative in the House, who has control over the spending, is the way you redress the grievances. So the people say to their representative, we don't want government to function like that. Don't spend that money anymore. Not only that, Madison said that the power of the purse was the most powerful control of government. And the reason that it was resting in the House was so that the House could, on the command of the people, control all the, what he called the overgrown prerogatives of the other branches. So when the executive and the judicial branch get grown out of control, then it's up to the House to defund their activities to bring them back into check.
So, two checks. So I'm hearing two checks, basically. The people withholding the payment of the taxes through their states, right? And then the House of Representatives refusing to fund programs or departments in order to keep the federal government in check. So with the 16th Amendment, which some say was illegally amended or what have you, but so we're operating on it regardless, however it got in there. And then the 17th Amendment that then basically disconnected us from our representatives
on the state level
puts us in a position of basically having those powerful controls removed. And so we struggle with controlling our government because those two keys have been corrupted. Am I seeing that correctly?
Yeah, that is right. And the interesting thing is, Jefferson's letter to Lord North was expressing the individual's right to withhold the payment of taxes to their government. And the individual, that was the only way the individual could respond, because they didn't have a state representative. They didn't have a senator. They didn't have a local House rep that they could control.
The Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
This is, I don't know about you guys, but this is so much fun for me. And I always love it when my husband JC is with me. I think sometimes you guys get tired of just hearing me talk by myself all the time. So, and I get such I get so much feedback from people how much they love you and they love hearing from you. You know, I think sometimes
I think they like it
when you're for me and I'm not even here.
They like hearing me rant and rave. So
now I rant every now and again. So
all right, I want to get back to you mentioned something earlier in the declaration where there was a grievance about the king sending out his ministers and officers to eat up our
substances. Yeah.
So we have, my goodness. Well, first off, let's go back to, can you just mention for the people one more time, the separation of, let's call it separation of responsibilities between federal and state as described by James Madison.
James Madison. Okay, so here's your original source document. Federalist 45. James Madison says, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those that remain in the states are numerous and indefinite. He says the powers delegated to the federal government will be exercised principally on external objects, foreign affairs. And then he names them foreign commerce. He says the latter of which will be tied to taxation.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole 16th Amendment thing gets thrown out by intent because the federal government was supposed to be collecting principally and primarily the taxation through tariffs, through foreign commerce, right? And so then he says, the powers that are reserved to the several states will extend to all the objects which involve within the ordinary course of the lives of the people, property of the people, the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. All of these objects, the lives of the people, the property of the people, the liberties of the people, the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state are reserved to the states.
Okay, so then...
Reserved.
So,
I mean,
so then definition, that description... In connection with the 10th Amendment, obviously, where, you know, the federal government was delegated certain responsibilities and whatever is not delegated is reserved to the states. So the internal order, improvement, the daily lives, the functioning.
In the ordinary course of affairs.
Of the states.
Of the states.
Would seem to preclude tons of these executive agencies at the federal level.
Right.
There is an agency at the federal level for just about everything you can imagine that you encounter within the boundaries of the state in your life every day.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're trying to, when folks like us are trying to talk to people about the invalid nature of these agencies, that they're stealing power from the states, they're not authorized. These things should be at the state level, not at the federal level, if you want to have them so that the people could control it there. And it was one of the questions.
Because the alternative is you have no control over it in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And or minimal anyway.
But the question in one of the folks asked, is when we're faced with trying to explain this to people, they seem to have a hard time imagining a world without these agencies.
Right.
So what's a good answer? And I looked up a couple of things that I found very interesting that I always think is pertinent with this question. But so what would you say? How do you explain that? When you tell your friends, the writer says, there are no constitutional authority for those agencies, how would the country operate in a world where these things don't exist at the federal level?
Well, the first response to that person, I would like to do what sort of what Jesus did. Answer the question with a question.
Yeah.
So when did those agencies begin?
Sure.
How long was there a period of time where we existed without them? And how did we get along without them?
Okay, so I got that. I got some of that right here.
Yeah.
NSA. Right, we can't we couldn't possibly be safe without the NSA.
And reading our emails.
It's got to protect us from terrorists and all that sort of stuff. So it didn't come around till 1952. So we got along, almost 180 years?
Mm-hmm.
We did okay without those guys. In fact, none of these agencies, I could find none of them that came along before
1900.
Yep. Like 1905, I think.
We're talking about the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the FDA, the FAA, the FCC.
FCC, 1934. Bureau of Land Management, 1946. So for 170 years, people were able to raise their cattle just fine.
Just fine.
You know, grow their crops just fine. You know, aside from extraordinary circumstances and different things, you know, the Dust Bowl and all that sort of stuff. And which I think is a good example, because what happens is, like Rahm Emanuel, you have some extraordinary circumstances or some emergency or some disaster either that happens or is concocted, and they seize on the crisis and say, people can't do this for themselves. It can't be handled on the state level. So this idea drives me nuts that, which is really kind of hypocritical. So you have this idea, the people that usually talk about it have a very sort of humanist, human-centered worldview, right?
Mm-hmm,
but
right.
Then at the same time, they suggest, they believe that, you know, apparently nobody can take care of themselves. Everybody's
right.
going to be an awful person.
Well, I would take that one step further. They don't believe that even, that we can even take care of ourselves on the state level.
Yeah.
Right? So my second response would be, well, if you want an NSA or an FDA, an FAA, FCC, BLM, EPA, whatever. Do it on the state level. Because that's where the power is reserved.
Yeah. So, but that's my question too, usually. What is the sort of
magic
fairy dust that makes a state politician somehow, you know, more ignorant than a federal politician or vice versa? What makes the federal government so magical that it has the know-how and the expertise to do all this stuff? Where, I mean, people are people, right?
Right.
Everybody that works in the federal government comes from a state.
Right.
So somehow they travel to D.C. and now they're more capable.
Well, let me ask you this question. If we return these agencies back to the state level, those same federal agents who worked for the federal government, if they go back to work for the state, do they suddenly get dumb?
Well, and now that you say that, here's an interesting thing. If you actually have it at the state level and that's where these people are, then guess what? They have to live under their own regulations and their own control.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the problems with having this stuff all at the federal level, that the people who make the laws, the people who come up with the regulations, enforce the regulations, do not have to submit to the regulations and the rules.
No, that's how the Flint
for.
Water crisis came about. That was not a Michigan fault. That was the U.S. EPA's fault. The river in Colorado that the federal EPA contaminated. We still will not know the ramifications of our future, what they did to that entire river because, oops, somebody at the EPA didn't follow the rules.
Yeah. So I would say to these folks, we got along for a century and a half, you know, 200 years, 100 years without these agencies. Did we all of a sudden get stupid? Is that what you're saying? And again, what makes the federal government so much more capable than the people close to you? And then why would you want to cede control and oversight to such a distant location?
To your own property.
Yeah,
right.
Where that you have a lesser ability to control and oversee these agencies in a faraway land like the District of Columbia, rather than closer to you within your own state if you want to have
these functions. Well, doesn't it make more sense that the people living in the state and living on the land would have a more vested interest in the care of that land than people who are so detached that all they see is a computer screen and bean counting regulations? They have no attachment to that land. Their children are not going to inherit that land. Their children are not going to eat and live off that land.
Yeah, I would say here's kind of an example to that answer that question. So if you had some sort of security system, right? Would you rather have a video camera, you know, filming your front door, and the officers or security that's supposed to respond in another city, right? Or would you rather have a guard shack right on your property? I mean, right. That's the idea. So, because the argument is, what we're talking about is, these are state functions. These are not federal functions. So the argument is, okay, if you want to have them, but they're reserved state powers.
Well, let's look at this from a real life perspective, okay? So I had a lady at a meeting, I don't think you were standing there at the time, come up to me and say, you know, I've heard your argument against the federal agencies. And she gave me the whole, but how would we operate without them thing? And she said, my example would be, she says, the FCC. Or no, sorry, I'm sorry, the FAA. Mm-hmm. She said, how is it that we would be able to facilitate travel between the states without an FAA?
Yeah.
I said, well, how do Germany and France do it?
Right.
They don't have a federal government. Yeah. You know, I mean, the European Union does not hand out regulation for that. In that matter, how does Great Britain and France do that? Because Great Britain's not part of the EU.
Yeah. How do you fly from country to country?
How do you fly from country to country? But I think that would be more relevant if Americans actually remembered that Georgia, Florida, California, and New York are countries.
Right.
We just happen to have joined together in a union like the European Union, but we did it first and we did it better. But we don't need the federal government to put up road signs for us and point fingers and regulate our travel, because we can do that. Well, we can communicate with each other.
I know I don't want to say too much, but when I was in the military, you know, we were studying Soviet flight control. I mean, they would pass off, one plane would pass off, or one control tower would pass a plane off to another control mm-hmm. tower. I mean, that's just the way it works. So
it's
why
the way it works.
Why couldn't you do that from state to state, place to place?
Because you can.
Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
Welcome back to the Chris Ann Hall Show. This is our last segment of the first hour. This is a segment where we have to say goodbye to certain people because some channels only carry the first hour. But I want to remind you that if you want to hear beyond this first hour, if you want to hear the second hour of the show, there you can always go to chrisannhall.com. And click on the Chris Ann Hall Show link, and you can download our mobile app for free. We are also on iTunes, on Google Music Play, and on TuneIn Radio as well. So there are several different ways for you to hear the second hour of the show. We are so glad to have you with the first hour, and so grateful for the stations that do carry us.
Yeah.
But here we are. Ask us your questions about the Constitution.
Okay, I have a really good question. This might be too big for the last segment, so it may go into the next half of the show. But I really like this question. It comes up a lot, and there's some heated discussions, interesting discussions. So Charlie says, way too many people claim that the Bill of Rights only places restrictions on the federal government and not on the individual states, leaving the states free to violate it at will. And so it's been said to me, all of this hinges on the incorporation doctrine. So they'll say without the incorporation doctrine, then the states are free to violate the Constitution or violate people's rights. So the question is the Bill of Rights intended to only place restrictions on the federal government, and what keeps the states from violating people's rights?
Well, first and foremost, what we need to remember from a legal perspective, the state constitutions preceded the federal constitution.
Okay.
And the federal Bill of Rights is actually an adaptation of the states already having these Bill of Rights. So every single state in the Union already has a Bill of Rights within it. And that's because the Bill of Rights is not the granting of people's rights, but the recognizing of the natural rights of the people. Recognizing, as Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. So the only reason that government, and I want to point out that he says, to secure these rights, governments,
mm-hmm.
okay, all throughout time, right. Governments.
Any government.
Any government is created with the single sole purpose to secure the rights of the people.
And deriving their just powers from the consent
right.
of the governed.
The consent of the governed, whose first law of nature is the duty to self-preservation, which involves the securing of your natural rights. Now, the other problem that we have with this idea of the incorporation doctrine is it operates on a certain false premise. And that false premise being that without the Bill of Rights, we wouldn't have these rights.
Right.
So, does the Bill of Rights exist to limit the federal government? And why doesn't it exist to limit the state governments? Because the Bill of Rights doesn't exist to limit any government.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why the Bill of Rights is there. There was a great debate. We actually teach a class called The Great Debate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great debate on whether we should have the Bill of Rights or not. And in that discussion, in that deliberation, we learn the reason that we have the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights is not there to limit the government. The Bill of Rights is there to remind the people of their rights, their inherent and natural rights, so that the government will never be allowed, permitted by the people, by the consent of the people, to trample upon those rights. And in that class, I think Alexander Hamilton says one of the most amazing things. He says, let me find this quote. Let's see. He says, "Why declare that things cannot be done, shall not be done, for which there is no power to do?" He says, why do we have to tell the government not to infringe on our freedom of speech, our freedom of press, not to infringe upon our right to keep and bear arms? Because the original constitutional document never delegated that power to them in the first place. Because remember, if it's not an enumerated, specifically enumerated power within the body of the Constitution, there is no authority to exercise it.
Let's get further into this on the other side. We are the light of the world. We've got a light, light, light it up now. We came to light it up.
The Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
Welcome back to our second hour here at the Chris Ann Hall Show. Remember, you can always find us at chrisannhall.com. And you can always find the best education on the planet on the Constitution at libertyfirstuniversity.com. Can I say that? The best education on the Constitution on the planet?
Absolutely.
I have to say that.
You don't have to, but
it's true.
You should.
I should. It's true. It's an education that you won't find at Harvard.
Right.
You won't find it at Yale.
You might find it outlawed at Harvard.
Oh, yeah. Right. Right.
Or many other campuses.
Right. I'm sure it's outlawed in Berkeley.
Okay. Let's get back. let's get into this. You may be attacked for this education at Berkeley. Let's get into back into the nature of the Bill of Rights. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
A very pertinent point, and I think that's sometimes surprising or shocking or sort of goes against the grain sometimes. So you said the Bill of Rights is not intended to limit the government. And I think I've heard you say further, which ought to be pretty obvious, not only is it not intended to limit the federal government, it can't.
No.
It has no ability to limit the
right.
federal government.
Right. Let's put it this way. If the articles of the Constitution who specifically enumerate the only power that the federal government is allowed to exercise, if those specific enumerations in and of themselves do not control and limit the government, an additional piece of paper will not either.
Yeah, the people control
right.
The government.
And that was the purpose of the Bill of Rights, by right. the way, was so that the people would control the federal
so
government.
How does Richard Henry Lee
yes.
Speaks to this? How does he
characterize
the Bill of Rights?
So actually it comes from an anti-federalist paper called Letter from a Federal Farmer to a Republican. Many people, including me, believe that's Richard Henry Lee. There are some people who disagree, but for convenience purposes, because it's my show, it's Richard Henry Lee.
Nevertheless, one of the thought processes, the opinions of characterizing the Bill of Rights.
Right, right. Now he says that not the executive branch, not the legislative branch, not the judicial branch. He says that the Republican jealousy and vigilance of the people is the strongest guard against the abuses of power in the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, when the Bill of Rights, he says, are well fixed between the powers of the rulers and the rights of the people, they become visible barriers, visible boundaries, constantly seen by all, and any transgression of them is immediately discovered. So we wrote them down so that they would be visibly in our mind and in our sight all the time. And the moment that anyone in government approaches our fundamental rights, we would be immediately raised in alarm and immediately do something about it. I love this part. He says that the Bill of Rights, they serve as a sentinel for the people at all times. Does a sentinel, is his main job shooting the enemy?
No.
The sentinel's job is not defending the fort. The sentinel's job is to stay in the tower and see the enemy approaching from afar away.
So that he can
sound the alarm. Right. Now you're a really pathetic sentinel if you don't sound the alarm until somebody's beating down your door.
Right.
So, the point by using that illustration of the sentinel is to say that the people are supposed to be paying so close attention to their federal government that the minute some politician, for example, says, we need to have a common sense debate on gun legislation, that's an enemy approaching from afar off, and the alarm should go off right away in our heads.
Yeah, but they don't, but it's not just watching the federal government.
Right.
They're also supposed to be so well acquainted with the Bill of Rights
right.
themselves that they know what the enemy looks like. So he
right.
so he describes the Bill of Rights as, let's say, restricting the federal government, not in the sense of shackles,
right?
But in the sense of an alarm,
right?
Like a security alarm,
right?
And so
in guard of the power of the government,
yeah,
but in guard of the rights and the liberties of the people.
So in the sense that the Bill of Rights may quote unquote restrict the federal government, it can only be in the same sense that a security alarm on your house would.
Right.
Right. The thief, the robber, has to respect the alarm.
Has
to believe it has teeth. Because if I know, by the way, many people probably have seen this. You can buy these little placards that you put on your lawn
mm-hmm.
that says you have a security alarm on
or
your
you
house.
You don't even have one.
Even if you don't. Okay. So if I am a thief and I put no credibility, I don't respect that sign. But even if you do have an alarm, alarm bells go off. Okay. If I know nobody's coming, nobody's hearing the bell, nobody's at home, you're not armed, then it doesn't matter how much the bell sounds, I'm still going to go in, right?
Right.
So in that sense, there's no way that the Bill of Rights by itself can restrict the federal government, right?
Right.
So it only restricts the federal government in the sense that it sounds an alarm to the government in saying, hey, this is what you're not supposed to do, but more importantly, in the minds
of the people
so
yes.
they can react when it happens.
To raise up, as Richard Henry Lee says, the jealousy and vigilance of the people, not of the Supreme Court, not of Congress, but the jealousy and the vigilance of the people, which he classifies as the strongest guard against the abuse of powers. Now, he also says in this letter why we have to write them down. He says they have to be visible barriers. They have to be well fixed between the powers of the rulers and the rights of the people. Notice he doesn't limit that to the federal government.
Sure.
He's talking like Jefferson did, in the broad sense of all government. Right. So between the rights of the people and all government, okay? And he says they have to be written down because there will be times, he says, unavoidable intervals of inattention.
Mm-hmm.
You see, these guys knew their history, knew human nature so much that they knew that the liberty they contended for would automatically bring in a prosperity. And with prosperity, people become pacified. They become lazy in luxury. They become complacent and compliant as long as they become comfortable. And the Bill of Rights was written down so that when we fell asleep or became less attentive than we should be, that alarm would arouse that liberty sense within us to immediately put up the stop guard for any government.
Right.
Any government.
But so let's not leave this, because again, so what's keeping the states from abusing it? So the person would say, well, if you suggest then that the Bill of Rights is not binding in a legal sense on the states, then that means they can do whatever they want.
No, because they're still binding in a moral sense from a natural law basis. It makes no difference whatsoever if you live in a federal government that is respecting your rights, if you live in slavery in your state.
When a person says that if the states are not legally bound by this Bill of Rights, then they have the authority to do whatever they want. Doesn't that imply then that our rights come from documents?
Yes, absolutely. Not only that, it also implies that you have no control over your local government. See, because remember, the control, as Richard Henry Lee said, always, Thomas Jefferson said in the Bill of Rights, they all say this, by the way, always originates from the people. And the reason that more power is reserved to the states is because that's where you have more control. And just because the Bill of Rights was not written to control the states, it was not written to control the federal government either. It was written to be a reminder to the people of their inalienable rights so that they would stand up for their rights in all government.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it is always up to the people, not up to the Supreme Court, not up to the President of the United States, but always up to the people to defend their natural rights.
So while it does, in a sense, stand to put the federal government on notice of the boundary, the restriction to not engage in those violations does not emanate from that document.
Right. No. The restriction to not violate our rights does not come from the Bill of Rights. The restriction to not violate our rights comes from natural law.
So in fact, if we had no express Second Amendment in a legal document, it would still be wrong for any of these forms of government
right.
to confiscate people's firearms.
Right, because you have a natural right to, by yourself, secure your life, your liberty, and your property. Because without that natural right to secure your life, your liberty, and your property, you are in servitude to whomever you depend to do that for you.
Yeah.
Because if you're waiting around for the government to protect your life, your liberty, and your property, then you are in servitude to them until they do it. What happens if those in power decide that your life, your liberty, and your property is not worthy of their protection? That they value their life, liberty, and property more than they value yours. Therefore, your life and liberty and property is not worthy of being protected. Well, that is a violation of natural law. It ends your right to self-preservation and puts you in the desperate state of servitude.
So, in reality, the sort of the idea that the 14th Amendment put in these safeguards is one superfluous, mm-hmm. or worse, it shifts the origin of rights.
Right.
It shifts it actually to government.
Right.
And their authorization through documents.
Well, it not only shifts the origin of those rights, it shifts the responsibility of preserving them.
Yeah.
So now not only do our rights, if the 14th Amendment is used in that meaning, not only do our rights emanate from government, but we are powerless without government to preserve our own rights.
But don't we really hear this a lot, though? I mean, I hear this a lot. It sounds like people are saying, they say, I have these rights because the Constitution says so. Or you can't violate these things because the Constitution says so. It really seems like a subtle and dangerous shift away from the source of our natural rights.
Well, maybe when we come back, we should talk about how we don't have any constitutionally protected rights at all.
Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
We're talking about natural law. We're talking about the inherent rights of the people. Now, the interesting thing is when you do a study of natural law, you find out that our rights precede government and that our government cannot exist if people do not originally own rights, because the whole purpose of government is to secure our rights. And government never has any true unjust authority above that of the individual. And so the Bill of Rights was there to remind the individual of their responsibility. I just wanted, before we moved on to this, I wanted to go into the preamble to the Bill of Rights. Most people don't realize there's a preamble to the Bill of Rights.
I feel like we should say, welcome back.
Oh, welcome back.
America. you don't have, nor have you ever had, constitutional rights.
Oh, that's right.
Congratulations.
We forgot. That's right. We left off with that, didn't we? Nobody in America has constitutional rights.
Nope.
That's shocking.
Nor have they ever had.
And nor have they ever had. You know, I say that.
Nor were they intended to have.
I say that when I teach the class. I say, nobody in this room has constitutional rights. Nobody in America has constitutional rights.
And they're waiting for the punchline.
Right. But the reality is, nobody has constitutional rights because your rights don't come from the Constitution.
Yeah, and I think that's important. It's not just some gimmicky little saying, mm-hmm. Not trying to be funny. I think it's important because
right.
It seems to me, even if people don't, acknowledge it sort of outright,
mm-hmm.
they act like it.
Mm-hmm.
They talk like it.
Mm-hmm.
We operate like, our rights come from the Constitution.
Right.
And we talk about
Second Amendment rights.
Second Amendment rights.
My First Amendment rights.
So
no.
It's a really subtle shift when there's like this seed of a shift of authority
mm-hmm.
planted in the minds, in the subconscious of people, in the way that we talk about these things. So it shifts from inherent rights by the nature of your creation to your rights come from documents. And,
right.
I think that's a little bit destructive.
I think it's very scary because if your rights believe, and many Americans do, I don't know, we've talked about it on this show before. I don't know if you remember that I had this whole Twitter debate with Chris Cuomo over this thing. And Chris Cuomo had to say that our rights come from law.
Mm-hmm.
And our rights come from government. And I said, that's a very scary thing, because that means if somebody rewrites the law, then I no longer have the right to speak. How could anybody believe that? I mean, the very nature of the job that Chris Cuomo has relies on an inherent
Chris
standing.
Cuomo is?
He's a journalist, but I forget who he's on, CNN or NBC, MSNBC.
So he operates under...
He operates
freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech, right.
Yeah. What always pops up in my mind.
Not your First Amendment right, by the way.
Yeah.
Freedom of speech right.
No, but when people like that say that, I want to go, oh, so you're a pro-slavery guy. I don't I don't meet many people who are in favor of slavery. That's amazing.
What do you mean? I am not in favor of slavery.
Yeah, you would have to be. If you think your rights come from the law, right? That means your rights come from an external source. That
right.
implies somebody owns you, somebody
right.
rules over you, somebody controls you, somebody else decides what you can and can't do, what you have a right to do and not to do. There's no, you know, so, I mean, that's it. If you say, my rights come from the Constitution, my rights come from the law, my
that's
rights
so right.
come from government, all this sort of stuff. Oh, well, that's a pro-slavery stance.
I know, it is like a fist bump for it. I like that one. That's so good.
Yeah, you believe in slavery.
That's crazy.
Clearly.
You know, a lot of these things, when you talk about them from a logical and reasonable perspective, they just completely blast hypocrisy on the words of those who try to be pro-government in
right.
that kind of way. It's
yeah,
just
our
disturbing.
Founders said they were self-evident. Didn't say
right.
they emanate from, you know, all these things. The protections, they could point to the protections that were written into law and the descriptions and declarations of rights through the Liberty Charters. But at no time did they say, oh, we got our rights from the Magna Carta. We got our rights from the Charter of Liberties.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the position. I mean,
right.
Cicero, long before, you know, these guys are ever even around, he talks about it's self-evident in nature. We look around, we can see creation, we observe creation, and these things are self-evident. I don't need permission to have rights.
No. And as I inappropriately started off, but we'll finish up here, the purpose of the Bill of Rights is actually explained in the preamble. It is not a limit on federal government, but a reminder to the people of their inalienable rights by keeping the government from redefining them. So when we come back, we'll go ahead and read that text so that everybody can know the purpose of the Bill of Rights.
The Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
So welcome back. I didn't forget that time. Welcome back to the Chris Ann Hall Show. Remembering that you can find us at chrisannhall.com. You can find the best education on the Constitution at on the planet at libertyfirstuniversity.com. And I want to mention, as far as this natural rights thing goes, the purpose of the Bill of Rights is in the preamble, and it's right stuck right there in the middle, to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its power.
Mm-hmm.
The government is not going to prevent its own misinterpretations. It's not going to prevent its own misapplications. And it's certainly not going to check itself not to abuse its powers.
Right.
The only thing that is going to keep the government from redefining, misconstruing, and abusing its power is the jealousy and the vigilance of the people, which requires knowledge to do that.
Well, here's another interesting thing in that, in the preamble to the Bill of Rights, you know, back to the discussion of whether they apply to the states mm-hmm. or restrict the states. This is interesting. As it leads off, it says the conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse. It was the states
mm-hmm.
that added it, right?
Right.
So it's the states directing this at the federal government. Let's put this alarm bell, this sentinel, let's set up this sentinel so that we can help the people control help the states
mm-hmm.
control the federal government. So the idea that it's controlling the states
right.
would say, okay, the states put the Bill of Rights in the Constitution to control the states.
Right.
The states were the authors of it. How
right.
would they restricting themselves? So that whole argument actually falls apart when you
right.
look at the document itself.
Right. And that's amazing. We have to start changing the way we speak. This idea of First Amendment rights, this idea of Second Amendment rights. And if we actually remember that the Second Amendment reads the right of the people to keep and bear arms, and that these rights of the people are not privileges that are given to the people, mm-hmm. but rights of the people inherent in the nature of their creation.
Right. And as far as the Bill of Rights, it says the states, the conventions in the states wanted further declaratory and restrictive clauses
right.
to be added. And, mm-hmm. and again, restrictive in the sense of that alarm
right.
system.
Right. And declaratory in the sense we're putting the people on notice.
Right.
Right? That constant visual boundary.
Right.
So do we have another question? Oh, you wanted to talk about the right to keep and bear arms, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's always popular with folks. Everybody's concerned about their weapons.
Right.
On both sides of the aisle. One side thinks somebody's coming to get them. And the other side thinks we have too many. There's too many out there. But we had an interesting discussion the other day. I was looking at, of course, we live in the state of Florida, and I was thinking about how the state of Florida has their gun laws mm-hmm. Sort of arranged and spelled out. And I think a lot of states are very similar to Florida. Some are even more restrictive, but there are very few that are better some are a little bit better. But even so, I realized it dawned on me that hardly anybody in America lives in a state where that they have the right to bear arms in a manner described in the Constitution. So
let's talk about the Second Amendment first. So the Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of the free state, the right of the
people
to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Infringed, right.
The argument is, well, the people doesn't actually mean the people. It means the government-controlled military or government-controlled forces, because it says a well-regulated militia. But in your study of the designers of the Second Amendment, we know that's not true, because they say over and over and over again that the militia is the whole body of the people. George Mason says not to include public officers. James Madison says in exclusion to any force the Congress can call together.
Yeah. Well, even if you permit, okay, let's say a militia is a body controlled by at the state level of these people coming together for whatever, it says the whole body of the people need
right.
to be armed to even be able to have
right.
a militia. And so there's no restriction in there that says, well, only people who are in military service have the right to bear arms.
Right.
That's something that they read in there that they create.
Well, they create it so that they can enlarge the power of the government and diminish the right of the people to keep and bear arms, which we learned in 1641 was identified as a mechanism to destroy the liberty of the people.
Right. So let's assume everybody listening presumes that we're talking about, that they accept that we have an individual right to bear arms. So do you actually enjoy a right to bear arms in your state?
Yes.
And
well, I think this is what we did in Georgia.
I would say no.
This is what we did in Georgia. Now, Georgia has a conceal and carry permit law.
Yep.
Which Florida has.
Yep.
A conceal and carry permit law. Florida does not have what they call constitutional carry, which you also open carry.
Which Georgia has open carry, right? I don't remember.
Georgia's
similar to Florida.
Right, I have it here. Georgia, you have to have a permit. You don't have to have a permit to purchase a handgun. You don't have to have a registration of your handgun. Georgia says you don't need to be licensed to own a handgun, and there's no licensing to own a handgun, but you have to get a permit to carry.
Right.
Okay, so that's the Georgia law.
Concealed carry or?
Concealed carry. Any carry.
Yeah.
I don't think they have open carry.
No.
They don't have open carry. And
but so some states have open carry. If you get a permit, you can open carry.
Right.
Some states, you can just open carry with no permit at all.
Right.
Right?
But you have to have a permit to conceal.
Right.
So what they call constitutional carry is not actually constitutional, because you still have to have a permit to carry it if you're not showing everybody that you have it.
Okay, so I'm going to go with Florida.
Go with Florida.
Right? Because
right.
I don't know all these other places. I live in Florida. and maybe this will resonate with some folks out there. So in Florida,
do you have to have a permit to have a gun in your home?
Okay, you can keep a gun in your home.
You can actually walk around with a gun in your pocket in your home.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, no, you can. Yeah. You can walk around with a gun in your pocket on your property.
But you can have a gun in your home.
Which means you have a right. Well, let's keep going. So in a car.
And then in Florida, you can have a firearm in your car.
Without a permit.
Without a permit, but.
But.
It has to be in, I forget the exact language, but a latchable enclosure. So like your glove compartment or the console in the whatever. You have to push a button to open something to get to your firearm.
So you can keep a gun in your car.
Correct. Under the stipulation of how it's kept in your car, right? It has to be in a certain container, how they say. You
know, all right. Latchable. Now in Florida, can you keep a gun without a permit,
so
out in public,
on your person in public,
you can't keep
so
it.
There's no open carry,
right?
You can't do that at all.
You can't keep it. Which I think the keeping clause in the public would be a concealed carry, and a bearing in public would be an open carry.
Okay, so you have to have a concealed carry permit in Florida, right?
But I think no open carry.
So they say, okay, you can transport it from place to place, it's got to be in your trunk or it's got to be in some enclosure, whatever. So these restrictions, mm-hmm. the restrictions in your car, and then of course you got to have the permission for on your person. So if you think about the right to bear arms and even how it's described in the Second Amendment, I would suggest in Florida, you don't have a right to bear arms.
Mm-mm.
It's gone. You have,
right.
That's been eliminated. So in Florida, your house has a right to keep and bear arms,
right?
You can have a gun in your house.
Right. Okay? And your house can have a gun sitting out in the open.
In your car, mm-hmm. they tell you, right? You have by permission. Okay. They say, okay, you can do it, but here's how you're going to do it. So it's like your mom or dad telling you, you know, how you got to wear this to school mm-hmm. and you can't wear that and you can't put, you know, purple paint in your hair. So you're right. So you really, right. that's not a right.
No,
that's a permission. And then on your person.
But your car doesn't have to have a permit.
Doesn't have to have a permit.
So, right, so your car
has a right to bear arms.
Your car doesn't need
a
permit.
So in Florida, your house has a right to bear arms. Your car has a right to bear arms. Or the glove box or console of your car has a right to bear arms.
Your car has a right to conceal carry without a permit.
That's true. You can put it in the trunk or whatever. Or in the console. So your car doesn't even need permission to conceal carry. But then on your person, right? Because when you talk about the Second Amendment, it describes the people's right to keep and bear arms, mm-hmm. not the people's house, not
right.
the people's coach or horse or wagon or
right.
car.
Right.
It's the people. And so in Florida, I've got to ask the government, right, the same entity for which the Second Amendment was written to protect me from,
mm-hmm.
right, the government. That's why I'm supposed to keep and bear arms, not to hunt, not to shoot robbers and that sort of thing. But in case of a tyrannical government rises to oppress the people, that's the whole purpose of right to bear arms. So in Florida, it's the closer it gets, right, from your home to your car to your person, the closer it gets to you, the closer it gets to what it looks like to actually keep and bear arms, the less liberty you have until when it's actually your person that we're talking about, people keep and bear arms. You don't have it.
No.
You have that by permission. And I would suggest that most states look like that. If
mm-hmm.
you really stopped and thought about how your state laws are constructed, your home may have a right to bear arms. Your car may have a right to bear arms, but probably you don't.
Right.
You bear arms by permission. You got to get a permit. You
right.
got to ask. You got to do all these things that the government says, here's how you're supposed to do it, when you're supposed to do it, when you can, when you can't. So in fact, the right to bear arms, we really carry on ridiculously about the right to bear arms and oh, they're taking this away and they're doing this and they're doing that. It's already gone.
Right.
It's practically already gone. If you're not in a state where it's pure constitutional carry, where you can carry any way you want to, you don't have to ask any government permission. If you don't have that, then that's it. You don't have a right to bear arms. You have a permission. You're permitted
right.
to bear arms.
And I think that the distinction here is the right to keep and bear.
Yeah.
Right, so it's not the same thing for me to go out to the store and buy it and put it in my house. That's keeping it.
Yeah.
But I also have the right to bear it.
Yep.
And if I have to ask the government permission,
then you don't have a right.
Then I don't have a right. I have a permission.
Yep. That's a privilege.
A privilege. A privilege that is given and taken away.
The king said you could approach the throne.
Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
This is our last segment.
Great.
I mean, that's crazy. Great. Like, wow, I'm glad this is over. Great.
It's been great. It's Welcome back to the Chris Ann Hall Show, the greatest show on the airwaves.
It's been fun. I love, like I said, I love doing this, but I love having all these questions. You know, we didn't even scratch the surface of all the questions that we have. We're going to have to do another show like this.
Yep.
I mean, we have to, and there's so many great questions that need to be answered.
Yeah, we got questions about war, about journalists, lying journalists, and mm-hmm.
I mean, there's one on the back. Did you notice they're on the back
there's
too?
There's a backside. There's all sorts
there's
of
backside.
Stuff.
And these are all from Twitter and, from Facebook and Twitter. Look at this one. Since the Second Amendment is about self-defense, where is self-defense found? The Second Amendment is not about self-defense. It's about self-preservation.
Right.
You know, self-defense against the government.
Yes, defense against tyranny. Defense against tyrannical government.
Taking of your rights.
Yeah. I mean, certainly right to bear arms, you know, an aspect of it is self-defense in the sense of self-preservation. But what was first and foremost in the minds of the designers was defense against tyranny, against a tyrannical
right.
government. You know, when you think of something like Hitler, I know they always say first to mention Hitler loses the argument, but when you think
did
of,
they say that?
Yeah. When you think of Nazi Germany, you know, and they come and confiscate the weapons eventually, mm-hmm. When you think about Soviet Union, Stalinist Russia and collecting the firearms. I mean, imagine an armed populace that's able to would have been able to stand up and had the will to stand up and stop guys like that. I mean, you're talking mm-hmm. millions and millions and millions of people murdered that could have been prevented with an armed populace with the willpower to rise up and stop that. I mean,
right.
that's the intent. That was what our founders had in mind. That
well, and their history dictated that when the people, when the government takes away from the arms of the people while the government remained armed, that was the sign that you have a tyrannical government.
Yeah. Well, what's really cool is people could sign up at Liberty First University
yeah.
and learn all of this stuff in great, great detail.
Just 10 minutes a day.
Yeah.
10 minutes a day. And you get a free workbook. The workbooks are amazing. He designs them.
I really enjoyed, we did a series on slavery and the
yes.
founders. And I really enjoyed doing that. It was conversational like this.
Right.
We talked through the topic because it's such an emotional topic for some folks.
Right.
And we wanted to get the truth of, you know, what our founders said, what were their positions, what were their statements, what
well,
went on in their
life. Well, because there's so many lies out there about, you know, we can't trust the Constitution because Jefferson was a slave owner and we've got to change the name of our high school because
well,
Madison owned slaves.
Yeah, and it's sad. And so many groups and people, you know, profit off of this hate mm-hmm. and division. And I think if we really talked about the truth of it, good and bad,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we'd be able to have a dialogue to actually address this thing. But it's so twisted in a manner to stir up one side or the other and just keep people pitted against each other. And so I really enjoyed doing that. I mean, that's at Liberty First University. I think that's worth the price of admission right there. And there's a workbook that goes along with it. There's actually, and I hope the people who are already enrolled, you're downloading the workbooks that go along with the video. The slavery class in particular, the workbook has more in there than we were actually able to include in the video. So you really, if you didn't print that out, you need to do that because there are a lot of references in there and resources and extra details that were not in the video that'll really help you and
well, many of the workbooks contain additional reading to supplement what you're doing. And if you're going to get the full benefit of the education that we're giving, you know, like I said, it's worthy of higher institutions of learning. You've got homework.
Yeah.
I mean, you gotta put into this, what the teachers always say, you'll get out of it what you put into it.
So great opportunity. People are signing up. go. I mean, those guys, you're listening, go enroll in Liberty First University. We're continuing to add classes, new classes all the time, at least two a month we're adding. And we'll continue to add. We're going to be expanding the entire site.
Rick Klausner.
We're eventually going to have a guide to the Constitution
on
the site.
Right, a guide to the Constitution, right.
That'll be great.
Rick Klausner said about the slavery class, he said, so emotional and so shocking that this, our history has been so distorted. He said, no better time to end the hate and no better way than by taking the slavery class.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for coming today. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. God bless you. See you tomorrow.
Let me know.